Yo, everybody, welcome back to Brand New Techish. We are back again. I am Michael Behain, and I'm joined with
Abadesi.
Yep, yours truly. We are Brock. And the first story of the day, let's get it cracking. I want to talk about Disney new streaming service.
Disney. Favorite Disney movie, go.
Jungle Book.
Yeah. Wow, you went for a vintage one.
I know everyone normally says Lion King, but Jungle Book has got a special place in my heart. You're going to say Lion King, aren't you?
I was not going to say Lion King, actually.
You are a Lion King person. Why are you lying?
You know me. You think
Why
you know
are you always lying?
Actually, I'm torn, honestly, between Pocahontas.
That colonial.
Aladdin.
That and Orientalism.
Beauty and the Beast. Stockholm Syndrome. I know. Look, they're not perfect, but these are the films that I grew up on.
It's true.
I know the soundtrack. I know the songs. As you know, I also recently saw Aladdin on stage in West
End. Yes. How'd you find it?
Highly recommend it.
It's amazing, isn't it?
So good.
Yeah, sick.
Aladdin live show.
Anyway, you're not getting paid for this plug.
I'm not getting paid for this, so I need to nip this in the bud.
But it's amazing when you watch a lot of the old Disney stuff, you're like, this is hella racist.
Pocahontas. As an adult.
And Pocahontas
tragic.
Is like, Pocahontas is like 10 years. It's not even that long ago. Maybe like 10,
no,
15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
The old school one, like
Sleeping Beauty. There are Nazis in that one.
Yeah, and even like, what's the one? Is it Dumbo? You just made the one.
I don't know if there
are wild allegation. No, there's one where what's the one where like they got the Jim Crow birds? The birds are called Jim Crow. Is it?
Oh, it is Dumbo.
Dumbo, yeah, and the birds are like,
right,
and they talk like, and
really,
like stereotypical, and the birds are called Jim Crow.
That's quite sad.
And even like in Peter Pan, there's one song called "What Makes the Red Man Red," and the whole song is about why the Native Americans are like red faced, and the song goes, "What makes the red man red?" Anyways,
wow.
Let's talk tech. So basically, Disney, the non-racist company, don't sue us, please, are now doing their own streaming service. They're going directly head to head with Netflix, and it's going to be $6 a month. They've pulled all their content from Netflix, and whatever's there left on Netflix will soon be down.
Wow.
And they're going to basically silo all their content. It's going to be on Disney Plus, and it's going to be Star Wars, Marvel, all the old Disney films, all the new releases. And yeah, I think it is a necessary move on Disney's behalf, and it is a very like clever and gangster move, but I fear for Netflix, to be honest, because if every single like content producer starts going direct to consumer, what does Netflix have apart from like, and their originals ain't all that, bro. They're not all that.
Come on. Are you kidding me right now?
It's hit and miss.
Stranger Things
is hard. Narcos is hard.
The
but
OA?
Like, nah, I didn't mess with that. I tried to watch it. I was like,
okay.
Okay, but apart from those shows, what else have they got?
There's all those documentaries, Making a Murderer. Why are you laughing at me? Dude, they have
struggle.
The new David Attenborough.
Struggle.
Look, I'm busy right now, but
okay,
I'm just saying, in general, they have the new David Attenborough.
As soon as I heard there's new documentaries, I just scoffed.
That's because you don't like documentaries.
I do like documentaries, but Netflix is not the place that I go to for my documentaries.
Where do you go?
Not Netflix.
Okay,
but anyway, I digress. Let's move on.
I'm just going to say, you are saying that there is an existential threat to Netflix and other streaming services when heavyweight content producers like Disney start pulling their content off, making their own streaming services.
Right.
So the reason I disagree with that is because I think more and more people are spending time consuming content.
Mm-hmm.
A subscription of $6 a month isn't huge. Look, let's face it, most people don't own their streaming subscription anyway. They're using moms and pops or like whoever's in whatever.
I'm the sucker of my one. I pay for my one.
Okay,
I've got
10
other people. I got 10 other people using my account.
You're
but anyways,
like
yeah. I'm
going
to cut all you off if you're listening. I'm joking. I'm blaming
you. Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank my stepmom because I use hers. And I just think we're moving towards a world where people have multiple subscriptions. I mean, even in my friendship group, I have some friends that have like 3, 4, 5 different subscriptions. They've got Apple Music, they've got Spotify, they've got Mubi, they've got, one of my friends is like literally a Mubi brand ambassador. He's like so obsessed with it. It's
what
like a
Mubi?
It's a movie streaming service where you get just a set number of films every month. So I think it might be like 20 new movies. And that way they remove the decision fatigue of deciding what to watch.
Right,
and it's
curated.
A curated selection,
cool.
Critically acclaimed, foreign, indie, you know, nice mix of films. But I think it's fine, you know, like let Disney do their own thing. And people that love Disney are going to invest in it. Disney is a strong brand. People get married at Disney.
Mm-hmm.
People go to Disney, you know, all the time. Like there's no competition there. It's fine. Think about it like this, right? Let's say, you know, Taylor Swift took all her music off Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
Did Taylor Swift fans stop paying for Spotify?
It's not an exact analogy because Taylor Swift is like, if like there was a whole record label and they were like, we're going to make our own streaming platform. And let's say this record label had like most of the big artists that we know.
Mm.
And they were like, we're going to do our own, you know, Universal Records, you know, Spotify version.
Yeah.
it would make a certain percentage of people like leave, I think, to be honest. If it's a critical mass, my concern for Netflix is that the advantage they had was that they had that kind of platform advantage, in the sense that they had built out this platform and they had distribution directly to their consumers, essentially. So if you're a content producer like a Disney, you probably couldn't be bothered to be like, all right, cool, we'll give it to Netflix. It's just another way for our consumers to watch our content. But once that advantage is gone, once Disney has that distribution, and once all the other content producers have that distribution also direct to consumer, then it becomes who's got the best content.
They're not substitutes, though. You see what I mean?
I get what you're saying, but I think there are certain people that will get fatigued and be like, you know what, I've only got X amount per month. Not everyone out here can afford $40, $50, $100
a month.
So you're
going to watch solely Disney content every day.
If I've got a child and I'm like, yo, I want to keep them entertained and I want to watch, you know, I don't mind watching Marvel and they want to watch the cartoons, then maybe.
That's it.
But I think where you're right is the fact that they priced it at $6 a month, which to me is their way of saying, we don't want this to be a Netflix replacement. We want this to be a Netflix supplement.
Add-on.
A supplement. But it's interesting because, like, it's what we mentioned with the music streaming awards as well, is that I was always taught in business that competition is good for the consumer. But in actuality, when it comes to all these different streaming platforms, it's a worse experience for the consumer because now the whole market is fragmented.
Exactly.
And, like, now I have to have 10 different streaming platforms.
So the share of my wallet that now goes towards entertainment is expanding, right?
Yeah,
it's like a higher proportion of my limited disposable income every month. I'm now having to spread across all these things. Oh, they're smart.
So the second story that I want to talk about is a tweet that sparked a conversation between me and you. It's from an individual called Gary Tan. He's actually a partner at Initialized Capital, which is Alexander Ohanian's VC firm.
Nice.
So the founder of Reddit and the hubby of Serena Williams.
Serena Williams.
Yeah.
Daddy to Olympia.
I'm not sure what their investment thesis is, but regardless, Gary tweeted out, if you're a startup and you're not growing 2x per year and you're wondering if you're failing, yeah, you probably are. The interesting thing is the vast majority of those who are in this situation don't ask that question and instead write very long, in all caps, investor updates.
Burn.
So what's your initial thoughts on that, about pardon the pun, on Initialized Capital?
It's pretty harsh. I mean, what we started to talk about was basically like, what is the definition of a startup then? So you're saying that startups have to be 2xing every year, delivering monster returns, racing towards that capital event to pay out the investors shareholders. It's kind of crazy because I see the word startup bandied around quite a lot. And of course, we all know that a startup is distinguished from a, you know, small or medium-sized business in the sense that it has the intention of scaling up very, very quickly.
Right.
And growing very quickly, whereas, you know, small, medium-sized business might be like, you know, I'm a cafe on the corner. I'm happy to stay a cafe on the corner. I'm not trying to become a chain and take over the world. But this idea of doubling every year, I mean, that is a huge criteria. And I just think to put that caveat on it actually eliminates the majority of people I know right now that consider themselves startups.
Oh, seriously?
I think
they VC-backed?
No.
Exactly. I think the crux of the issue is, what is a startup? And we were saying off mic that I said, essentially now, he's framing it that if you're not VC-backed, you're not a startup. Because I agree with that tweet in the sense that if you are in a VC-backed situation, that is the requirement. Because there's no other way the investors are going to get their return on investment. They're not investing in you for, you know, for shits and giggles. They want a return on their capital, and this is the criteria.
That would be a funny name for a VC fund, though.
Shits and giggles. Yeah.
That's true. We just burn our cash.
Shits and giggles capital. So anyways, like, as I was saying,
someone's
like,
going to buy that domain. Let me hop on
let's have a look.
Right,
let's have a look. And we'll come back to that. But the point I was making is that, yeah, what is a startup? So, for example, someone like me who runs a company that is based on code. I write code. I have a platform. I have customers. By this definition, I'm not a startup because, A, I'm not aiming to grow 2x per year. A, B, I don't have any investors. So am I just a small business? And I don't mind that. If we're going to start saying that a startup is only something that a VC backs, then cool. And everybody else that's bootstrapping, we're running businesses. I think that would actually be healthier for a lot of us bootstrap founders, because I think a lot of times we get caught up in the startup kind of ecosystem and we're not really part of it. We are building businesses. And I take pride in that because a business is a real tangible thing.
Yeah.
I was watching this documentary called Generation Startup. It's on Amazon. And it basically follows these young entrepreneurs who are taking part in this group called Ventura for America. It's like a non-profit that kind of helps young people start companies in like dilapidated areas in the States. It's founded by Andrew Yang, who's running for president now, the guy behind, he's running on UBI, Universal Basic Income.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, I digress. So in the documentary, there's three or four startups, and I Googled them all afterwards, and they all failed. Like one of them, you know, they were struggling, then they raised money from YC, and this documentary is about 3 years old, and about, you know, one out of the four made it, and the majority just like crashed and burned. I went on their website, the main hit, nothing. Yeah. Kellogg's and Crunchbase closed down.
Yeah.
And it's like, those people expended so much energy. And it's the harsh reality that one in four will probably make it past 3-4 years.
Yeah.
And it's like, if that's what it is, personally speaking, that's not the odds that I want to mess with, honestly. I'd rather start small and have revenue and not try to shoot for the moon and get shot down in 3-4 years, because these guys were hustling. They were doing like 15-hour, 16-hour days, and after 4 years, like, they had nothing to show for it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's to me, that was like, I was like, wow.
So yeah, I mean, you know, Forbes wrote 90% of startups fail in 2015.
Right. But then what did it, because it's confusing, because some people think startup means new company.
Interesting.
So startup doesn't mean new company. It doesn't even mean new company that's a tech company. It's a startup, therefore, by this guy's definition, Gary Tan, is basically a startup, is a tech company that's backed by VCs, because the focus is on growth.
Right.
I feel like, and Paul Graham in the comment section, he posted a link to his article, which was basically a startup is a company that's focused on growth.
Got it.
And that is the distinction that you have to draw.
And what growth though?
The 2x, I guess. As
but
in
what has to 2x? Is it profits? Revenue. Is it users? Is it
everything.
Revenue?
Whatever your KPI is. So if you're doing a social network, I guess 2x your user base, maybe.
Or your or engagement. Users or whatever.
Right, yeah. Mm. If you're charging customers, then you say 2x profit. In fact, to be honest, if you're doing a social network and you're doing 2x, you're probably messing up.
Mm, you know what I mean? You want to be getting some you need to be doing like, growing faster than that. I think the important point that you're making as well is like, what are we optimizing for? You know
money.
What I mean? Yeah, no, but like for real. And that's the thing that I think is really upsetting, right? Because we're kind of looking around the world and being a lot of frustrated by a lot of the problems we see and the things that haven't changed.
Mm.
And that's because in these situations within capitalism, we've optimized for money, creating as much of it as we can without thinking about what the consequences of that are. Often a lot of really nasty, unintended ones, but real nonetheless.
Mm.
And I think it's really important for us as entrepreneurs, tech workers, or just anyone, you know, a person in society to think about, you know, what are like the different drivers of change in society and like what role we want to play in that. And I think, you know, entrepreneurs have a very important role here. They want to like shape the world to their vision. What means are they going to go about doing it? Because let's face it, some really great ideas have been chewed up and spat out by venture capital.
Oh, of course.
You know,
yeah.
Companies are encouraged to grow too quickly, scale too quickly. Visions are diluted or shifted or changed. I don't want to speak too negatively about investors because I know a lot of really great ones. But the truth is, you know, they have to play the numbers game. And they have to think about everything that's going on in their portfolio and what they can do to maximize the return. And often their incentives are not perfectly aligned with the incentives of the entrepreneur or the target market that the entrepreneur is serving. And I think, I hate to bang on about it again, but we talked about Zebras United before. And I think any movement that's trying to play the fuller picture out of the pros and cons of pursuing venture capital and and basically being mindful of exploring other access to capital is just so important.
Yeah.
And if you're a founder, you need to remember that.
I think actually this is just taking like a holistic look at it. We have to be thankful for VC-backed companies because in actuality, they have now created an environment where you can start a capital very low investment. So like there's Heroku for hosting, it's Amazon Web Services. Now there's like, you know, MailChimp. There's all these companies, okay, maybe MailChimp's a bad example because it's not VC backed, but there's all these companies that there's now an ecosystem of all these companies that make it really easy to start a company cheaply. So ironically, we need VCs lesser than ever. Like I didn't need a VC to get started. I was able to charge customers from the get-go. So it's like I'm thankful to the VC industry for helping us build all these, you know, to help build the ecosystem to help small business entrepreneurs like myself. But you're no longer as necessary as you once were, if that makes any sense.
Preach.
What was I going to say? Yeah. So following on from that conversation, Jack Ma, CEO of Alibaba, he started a bit of a firestorm on Twitter because he basically, I don't think he tweeted it, but I think he was quoted as saying he believes in the 996 philosophy. So in China, he says, well, if you want to work for Alibaba, he says 996 means from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. And it started a bit of a firestorm on Twitter because kind of like this whole jingoistic conversation where it's like, we're losing to China. A lot of like, so Jason Calacanis.
What was it when you said jingoistic?
Jingoistic, yeah. Jingoistic means like when it's like nationalistic, very much like our country's the best. We're losing this thing. We've got to beat them. Yeah. So Jason Calacanis, who's an early Uber investor and quite a prominent tech person, he was like, yo, we've got to do this. Like, we're losing to China. Like, and China's going to win. And China is like, is an authoritarian state. So if China becomes the biggest, then it's real nationalistic type BS. Mm. It's almost outside of now, like, an economy type situation. And almost kind of echoing Trump's thing about, like, you know, we're at war, we're in an economic war with China, blah, blah, blah. But just going back to the base of it, 996, how you feel about that? You willing to do that? I'll hire you, Abba, if you work 996 for me.
No. It's funny because in some ways it's not unfamiliar to me.
Yeah.
As you know yourself, being not only an entrepreneur, but like having worked in early stage startups and stuff like that. But I think we need to look to what actual research and experts in productivity are talking about, and what the research shows and what the data shows is that we're not our most productive purely based on time, right? So there's no guaranteed positive correlation between time spent working and productivity.
Yeah.
On the contrary, what we experience is diminishing returns.
Right.
So I think what's really interesting about this is like it feels more ideological than practical for some reason to me. Like, I don't feel like this is a new debate, and I certainly don't agree with it. I think one thing that I found really inspiring recently and actually relatable as well was a study that showed that the most productive people are people that work in a burst of 50 minutes followed by a 10-minute break.
Right.
And they might have anywhere between like 6 and 10 sessions of these on any given day. So it's very similar to Pomodoro. Everyone's aware of the Pomodoro technique. I have a Pomodoro app. Pomodoro was another productivity hack that came out of a research study where people were asked to work on a task uninterrupted, focus time for 25 minutes, followed by a 5-minute break, and complete as many of these so-called Pomodoros as they could. And what people found was completing anything from like, you know, 3, 4, 5 Pomodoros in one day was infinitely better than actually sitting at your desk for like 9, 10, 11, 12 hours max. So I think it feels like a lot of rhetoric. I mean, first of all, I mean, China and labor laws and human rights in general, like, are we seriously going to start talking about that right now? Like, not saying that America is any better because, like, hashtag slavery, but, like, you know. But I don't like it. Honestly, like, I just don't like it. I feel like it's so converse to all of the conversations we're having around mental health, work-life balance. We're talking about the highest suicide rates in men, you know, the struggles of, like, all type of people, particularly underrepresented people, particularly marginalized people. Structural oppression, debt, spiraling debt, flat to low wage growth, but, you know, high cost of living increases, interest rates have been low, so there's no point in saving. I don't know. I just kind of feel like putting this in the context of what's happening, like, at a macroeconomic level just feels really disheartening because it feels like it just puts an extra squeeze on individuals. And who will gain from this, right? So everyone's just like, yeah, this is how you make a country great. Well, I'm sorry, because what am I as an individual getting out of this? And I'm not saying let's all be super individualistic right now, but I'm saying let's just be a bit humane and compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, people are going to die. People are going to die.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be overworked in, like, and stressed.
There's a word in Japanese, because there's the syndrome of where people are dying from overworking.
Wow.
Where people, like, they just find them dead on the desk. It sounds like complete hyperbole, but it's the actual truth. Just look it up. This actual, like,
wow, that's so
real incidents of, like, it happens so often they had to come up with a word of, like, this person has just died from overworking.
What do you think?
You know what? Am I gonna say that there aren't times where I've done a similar schedule? There are times where I have been doing that, and I'm not gonna front. But as someone who's, you know, trying to get a company off the ground, I kind of expected that. Now, if I had a team of like 100 people, would I expect everybody to copy me? No. And I think you've got to realize that you can't expect everybody to care about your vision as much as, you know, as much as you. It's not going to happen. And no, let's keep it real. Like, putting on a Marxist hat, there's different dynamics between an owner and an employee. And there's different dynamics between an investor and an employee. Like, it's very easy for Jason Calacanis and Jack Tang, who are owner operators or just investors, to essentially, they are investing in human labor. They are trying to churn out as much value from it as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And they're thinking about it like it's any resource, not realizing that people are not, you know, widgets coming out of a factory. You can't just do that. You can't expect that. Is there an element where... I don't know. Is there an element where we could lose out to China? Exactly, this is the point I'm going to make.
China, cut me in on that pie.
Yeah, personally speaking, I don't see the world in that kind of win-lose type of situation. I hate to use the word win-win, but I think, for example, David Hannemar Hansen from Basecamp, he was like, yo, the US economy is much bigger than the Danish economy, but how does that affect the Danish people on a day-to-day basis who are ranked consistently as the happiest people on earth?
Mm.
It doesn't have any impact. Like, if China is the biggest economy in the world, like, what... realistically speaking, like, what impact would it have to me and someone in London living my life? Like,
I know.
Would it
make me? So it's just like a dick swinging contest.
Completely.
Oh, my economy's bigger than your economy.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, but let's look at it at micro level. Like, who's actually got a better life?
I really feel like this type of stuff, like, we have to be careful, because I hope, like, in our children's lifetime, there isn't some kind of direct confrontation between the two countries. I feel like that's where it's kind of heading towards right now on a subliminal level. Like, because, like, we're constantly saying, like, yo, like,
another they're beating us.
Yeah, like, at the very least. Anyways, on that...
I'll just say one final thing.
Go on.
In February, Derek Thompson, a staff writer at The Atlantic, published an article called Workism is Making Americans Miserable.
I can believe that.
Touched on it very briefly, but the tagline or the subtitle was, "For the college-educated elite, work has morphed into a religious identity, promising transcendence and community, but failing to deliver." So there's just like one thing I kind of want to point out here. A lot of the themes that we experience in life today relate to a feeling of isolation and disconnectedness.
Mm.
So in many ways, we're actually like the loneliest we've ever been, despite having technology that makes it easier to connect with one another.
Mm.
That's why people are addicted to social media. But social media, even in itself, the way that we interact with it, is also quite alienating and forces us to constantly compare ourselves. And, you know, it brings out the worst in us, the way the products are designed to become addictive and, you know, compulsive. And ultimately, we remain unhappy.
Yeah.
And I think there is something to be said, particularly within tech and Silicon Valley, where, again, the dominant group of people is quite homogenous and college-educated white elite that is not religious or necessarily connected to any other type of community in which they find connection other than other tech workers.
Yeah.
To say that, you know, what they're writing about in this article, work as a new religion, kind of makes sense, because if you identify yourself as an entrepreneur, then for you to have a positive identity, you must be a successful entrepreneur.
Completely, yeah.
And for you to be a successful entrepreneur, you might feel you have to work all the time. Therefore, to be you and to be a positive you is to be working all the time.
Yeah.
But as you do that and as you pursue that, you actually become quite unhappy. And then there's this like horrific kind of duality where you're like doing all the things that you think you should be doing, but you're actually deeply unhappy. And so you're like microdosing LSD and like Burning Man shamanic rituals and therapy and all this kind of stuff. So I kind of feel like that is something I would like people listening to be mindful of. Like, is work your identity?
Yeah.
And how can you make sure that that's not actually like an unhealthy dynamic?
That's why I'm always pro diversifying your identity. So like someone like me, I try to do as much hobbies as I'm not great at it, but I try to have hobbies. So that when I think about myself, I don't just think founder, because that can be taken away from me any minute now. Like, I'm one recession away. All of us are one recession away from losing everything as entrepreneurs. So like,
what are your other hobbies? Knitting.
I draw sometimes. I read a bit. Yeah, you know, I'm artistic. Don't get twisted. Like, if I keep it in the D, I keep it. I write stories as well. So, like, you know, I keep it close to the chest. But stuff that I can just say to myself, okay, cool. Like, I'm more than just this one thing, because I can't control this one thing. This is out of my hands. Anyways. Yeah, so speaking of Netflix, I spent the first section like kind of saying they're done, but I watched last night the Beyonce Homecoming thing, and it was sick. Yeah. Did you watch it?
I know, yeah. I'm saving it for the weekend.
Like, it's really good. It's like it's a concert, but then interspliced is kind of like her preparation for the concert, see the grind. Because she just came off having twins.
Yes.
And she had like 8 months to kind of get ready for this unbelievable performance. And the grind was incredible. And then even at one point, she was like, yo, like, I had to go on this crazy diet. And it was like, no bread, no carbs, no meat, no fish, no alcohol.
What was
she eating? Like, pure plant-based.
Wow.
Yeah, pure. I mean, when she says no carbs, it must be like lentil. Unless she's literally just eating salad.
Wow.
But like, the dedication was unreal. Wow. I was like, well, you know what? Beyonce's doing that 996 for real. Like, Beyonce's going in. Like,
girl, but like 24/7.
Yeah, but she. But the thing is, what's interesting, I was reading up on it, and it was like she got paid like $4-5 million for it. And I was like, I'm not gonna lie, she should have got paid more because the grind she did for 8 months to get ready. I was like, yo, she undersold herself. But,
wow.
Also, have you seen that? You know, Rihanna and Donald Glover got film out.
Guava Island. Yeah, yeah. I'm also saving that for the weekend. Trailer did not give a lot away.
You know what? I watched the first 20 minutes and it was kind of boring.
Don't say yeah. that,
it's
man.
Hurting me, fam.
No, don't
it
say
hurt
that.
Me. I watched
don't
the first 20
that.
Minutes. I was
it's
like
two of the people I love the most.
I
in this
know.
World.
I wanted it to be so good. I wanted it to be entertained. But you know what? It's like, and the thing is, it's only 50 minutes. So like, I'm kind
it's
of.
It's a rom-com.
It's not a rom-com. It's kind of like a quasi-musical.
Because okay,
throughout
cute.
The song, throughout the thing, he goes into songs, some of his own songs.
Is she singing?
No, she's not.
No.
Yeah, so he when I watched it, he did This Is America and a few other songs. But then what was off-putting is that it's set in Cuba, as in not set in Cuba, it's filmed in Cuba, and it's meant to be in this place called Guava Island. But like, some people have like a Jamaican accent, some people have like an Afro-Cuban type accent, and Donald Glover has like an American accent. I'm like, this don't make no sense. I can't get over this. Like,
what? Because everyone has to have the same accent in a place?
Come on,
what's wrong with you?
As in, like, it's got to be like. No, it was too much of a leap. But anyways, everybody make up your own mind.
It's
check it out.
It's not Marvel.
Yeah, you got me. So yeah, this is an interesting story. So Jumia, which is like an e-commerce platform that operates throughout Africa, recently publicly listed on the NYC Stock Exchange. And
make it rain.
They make it rain, but they try to brand themselves as an African startup.
Africa. I'm just going to do sound effects throughout this whole story. You just talk.
Okay, cool.
I'll do the noises.
So like, they try to brand themselves as like an African startup, and people weren't really happy. Essentially, it started by two Frenchmen, incorporated in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
My people then at Rocket Internet. I said they're my people then. They're not my people then. But Rocket Internet
those
is
are my
it.
People from Groupon days.
Oh, seriously? Oh, yeah, right. So
yeah,
Rocket Internet is like,
the
Samar
Brothers.
Is this funded by the Samar Brothers?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Samar Brothers are two guys that sold their startup many years ago, and they founded Rocket Internet. Rocket Internet are known
clone
as like the
factory.
Clone kings. Yeah, they'll clone like eBay, they'll clone like Amazon. So they've helped create this company called Jumia, which is like an Amazon for Africa, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people are upset about the fact that they branded their startup as African because it started by two French people, it's incorporated in Germany, it operates in Africa, but the only thing in Africa are its warehouse workers. All the developers are in Portugal. So when they were on CNBC, there was some pushback, and they were like, yo, like, you're trying to brand yourself as an African startup here just to get the kind of kudos, but there's nothing really African about you. So what's going on? Like, BMW and Google operate throughout the whole world. It doesn't mean that BMW is a local company to whatever country that it's in. It's
yeah,
a German company, and Google is an American company. You know what I mean? So I'm kind of caught in two minds because I think it will probably help in terms of the investment cash into Africa in terms of startup opportunities. But at the same time, I'm also like, and there's a great Twitter thread, but I'll get the guy's, the individual's name, TMS Rouge. He called it a form of digital colonization because he was like, yo, this is just outsiders capitalizing on the continent and they're trying to use the continent as a way to kind of get cachet and you know.
What,
and leverage that brand name.
To get press.
To get press, yeah. And to make it look like a better story than it actually is. By saying it's an African startup, because we all want to believe that story. We all want to be like, even my homie, he sent it to me. He was like, yo, man, African startup like thing. And I said, I broke it down to him. He was like, wow, I wouldn't even have read like anything more than the headline. So I would have got roped in, he said. And I was like, yeah, like, we've got to look deeper. Initial thoughts, Abidesi, because you look like you're not sure which way to take it.
I think it's difficult because they serve an African market, but there's no African ownership. That's the dispute, right?
Yes.
Ha, la 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 la.
What do you think?
I mean, it doesn't feels problematic to me.
Yeah.
It feels problematic. Why can't they just say they're German or French?
Because it doesn't have the same brand value. It doesn't have the same like headline.
You can't just choose when you want to be African.
Yeah, but I mean, like they there is a credible way that they can say it because they do operate in Africa, but it's like it's a fudging of the truth. It's dodgy, man. But a lot of like prominent African tech entrepreneurs are pushing back saying no, because one in this Twitter thread, TMS Rouge, he was like, listen, the idea of getting publicly listed on the New York Stock Exchange is unfathomable for a lot of African entrepreneurs. So you have two European entrepreneurs who have the access, who have the connections, who have the infrastructure, who have the capital, and they're doing it and they're trying to claim that, yo, like, you know, we did it and we're African, so why can't you? Mm. And in CNBC, they were like, why aren't your developers African? They were like, well, we couldn't find the quality of talent. And it's like, yo,
Andela.
Everybody check out Andela. They're a really great training facility for African developers. I went to visit them in Uganda. They're sick. But
Wakanda forever.
Like, I don't know, man.
I don't know. I think it is. It feels a bit cheap. It feels a bit lazy. And it's also like, if you're African, then like give African ownership or like be relevant. Okay, they operate exclusively in Africa.
Right.
And also, say you operate exclusively in Africa. Don't say you're African. But is this their fault or this is the press's fault?
I think they've pushed that narrative to the press, so I don't think they're blameless whatsoever. In fact, they when they were on CNBC, that's how they were portraying it. And even the presenter on CNBC was like, yo, like, for real? And the guy was like, no, most of our employees are in Africa. And he's like, yeah, because they're warehouse workers. Mm. They have to be close to the source. In fact, actually, what the other criticism is the fact that most of the brands on Jumia are, like, foreign brands.
Got it.
So, like, in Africa, unfortunately, there's, I say in Africa, there's 54 countries, but in a lot of what I've seen and what my experience is as a part of the African diaspora when I have gone to the continent is that we don't trust our local brands and we're still just like, yo, where's Coca-Cola? Like, where's this? Like, so Jumia sells a lot of foreign brands into the domestic market. Yeah. And don't get twisted, it's great for the African consumer to have that choice. I'm not disrespecting that. That's great. Like, I can't say I don't want them to have the same access to products that I have. Great for them. But it does play onto that fact that local, what we can produce isn't good enough and that therefore we need the big multinationals from outside to come and, you know, give us a blessing. Do you know what I mean?
Obsessed with imported goods. Do you not see, like, the Nigerian, one of the Nigerian ministers had to complain in parliament recently because Nigerians were importing pizza on BA flights. Nigerians, and I'm not even joking, they were literally, like, getting their mates in London to, like, get pizza.
That pizza would be cold as hell, though. 12-hour pizza.
Put it, man. Put it in there.
Oh,
and it's all good.
Lord.
And they were basically, like, yeah, yo, just get, you know, whatever my favorite pizza is, I don't know, put it on the plane. Now someone on the other side now collects it for them, brings it to the house, and they're importing pizza.
That's crazy.
Desperate situation.
That's crazy. Well, everybody, that brings Techish to an end. Thank you so much for listening. Use the hashtag Techish like we always say.
Hashtag Techish.
Hashtag Techish. Catch us on Twitter at @MichaelBehane_.
Abadesi.
Simple dimples. And yeah, we'll catch you next week. Like,
that's not a saying. It is now.
It is now. I made up. Catch us next week. And yeah,
we love you. If you haven't already subscribed,
that too.
Please do.
Subscribe.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode and you think someone else in your life might too, you know, a friend, a relative, a colleague, why don't you forward it on to them? And if you have any thoughts about what we've discussed or have ideas for what we can discuss in future, use the hashtag Techish on Twitter and let us know.
All right. Ciao. Bye. Peace.